This is a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. As the Radio Boston team takes a holiday break, we are bringing you some of our favorite conversations from this year. Today, a discussion that centers on a theme we could apply to so many aspects of our lives over the last 2 years. This changes everything. Whether it's healthcare, housing, transportation, work, even our social interactions, the pandemic has had a staggering impact on all of us, and not just on an individual level, but also on an institutional level. In some ways, it's exposed deep-rooted inadequacy and injustice long bubbling under the surface. And in other ways, it has raised important questions about why we do things the way we do, and whether our approach to framing issues is inappropriate, outdated, and it has certainly made everything more complicated. Today, we focus on universities, which are scrambling over this holiday break with the rise of Omicron. Should students study abroad next semester? Can they come back to in-person learning after being far flung during the break? Back in September, I sat down with four college presidents at WBUR CitySpace to talk about how the pandemic has changed everything and what that's meant to students, staff, faculty, members of the surrounding communities. You'll hear from Pam Ettinger, president of Bunker Hill Community College, Paula Johnson, president of Wellesley College, David Green, president of Colby College, and Bob Brown, president of Boston University. And for full disclosure, Boston University holds the broadcast license for WBUR. We covered a wide range of topics during the hour, but I started by asking each of the four, what were the biggest invisible disruptions that the pandemic had brought beyond, you know, obvious health concerns and logistics of abruptly transitioning to a remote learning model?
The biggest disruption for everyone was the combination of disruption in their life, their living style, their family, the anxiety around that, and at the same time, with our staff and faculty, coping with this massive pivot that we had to do in the way we educate our students and go about our business. And it was the coupling of those two things that I think was the hardest issue to deal with. And I think that's probably true in almost any firm, that has a large service component like we do.
Did any of that catch you particularly by surprise?
I think in my – and I've been in the kind of higher education leadership positions for many, many years. I had never seen it so pervasive among the faculty and staff. And the anxiety level caused by a disease that has killed over 600,000 people in the United States and the commingling of that with the rest of their professional life. I've never seen anything like it before.
Thank you for that. So same question to you. Would you like me to repeat it or are you good?
No, it's fine. I sort of want to flip the question on its head in that COVID revealed what was hidden before. For decades, right, community colleges are where folks go if you're looking for an education that is affordable and we really don't notice as a society what goes on. It's kind of like a black box or a mystery. It's not your traditional college type of experience. But what we've realized during COVID is that students who come to us are not monolithic. So we have some traditional college students. We have some adults. And what COVID has done is that it sort of ripped off the cover. And we realized how badly funded and how broken the systems that these students are living with in education, in healthcare, in transportation, in childcare, all of the pieces that are barely holding together in our communities, particularly communities of color and communities of poverty. They were barely holding together for those students to go into higher education to get a better life, right? To sort of get to social mobility. But when COVID hit, all of that fell apart. And what we got to see was really a reveal of how those systems weren't holding together enough. It was a huge shock, even for those of us who've been in the business for, you know, two or three decades. But there is also a lot of hope there. But now that we're able to see what's broken, that the social contract is broken, that it's possible for us to be more mindful about rebuilding it. And that's really where the hope is. It was a shock. And, you know, all the anxiety that, you know, that President Brown referred to is still in the environment. We're nervous. Faculty are nervous. Students are nervous. But there's also a layer of social desperation that feeds into that anxiety.
Thank you. That wasn't a stop. That was just a soon. President Green, how about you?
Well, I'll give you a happy surprise that came out of all of this. Last year, we had all of our students back, faculty back. We taught in person. We had people living, all students living on campus. We had a great year through all of it. And there were a lot of people who told me, especially parents when they dropped their students off, we're so glad you're doing this, but we'll see you in about 3 or 4 weeks when it all goes bad. It never went bad. And the difference to me was the kind of shared sense of purpose and the culture, the strength of the culture, better than I had ever seen it. And the sense that we want to be here, we're going to make the most of this, and we'll give up things to be here. We will take care of ourselves. We'll take care of other people. We'll make sure we take care of this opportunity that we have to be together. And it was extraordinary. From a cultural perspective, campus culture was the best year we ever had. And we're starting this year in the exact same way. You know, everybody knows that expression that education is sort of wasted on the young and foolish in many ways. But there's a tinge of truth to all of that, especially for those of us who think, boy, if I could go back, I would do it differently this time. These students did it right this time. They don't have to think about that 20 years from now, about what mistakes they made. They actually took nothing for granted while they were there. And I'm seeing the same thing happening again this year. And I think if that's a continuing trend that comes out of this, you know, we'll all be for the better for it.
Thank you. President Johnson.
So, you know, it was a very interesting, frightening time. And as we went into March of 2020, we had just launched our strategic planning process the summer before. So we were in the middle of interviewing and doing all the background work. And we then, of course, hit the pause button and did everything that everyone else was doing. But when we came back in the fall, and when we restarted the planning process, albeit remotely and in various ways, we had half of our students on campus, I think we really came back with a renewed sense of purpose. And I think it's kind of building on what President Ettinger said, was that we came back with a renewed sense of purpose and that we had this, that cover ripped off in terms of the lives of our students. We were able to see very clearly that as a residential campus, when our students come to campus, it is an equalizer of sorts, not fully, that we were able to see into our students' homes. We were able to see into the homes of various people who were working remotely. And we also appreciated those who didn't have a choice. And I think that with that came a renewed sense of purpose and doubling down on our commitment to what we call inclusive excellence on campus, greater sense of belonging, thinking about equity, increasing. We've got a phenomenally diverse campus, but really making sure that we were really embracing that diversity. And then really focusing on gender equity as we looked at the desperation around the issues of childcare. And as a women's college, obviously, really making that front and center as well in terms of the determination moving forward.
So what's striking me in listening to all of you, and any of you can feel free to answer this, but some of these themes are things that it feels as if you are naming them, that the pandemic gave you a way to name the failures and breaks in our systems, to name the importance of purpose in the culture of your institution, to name the social issues where you had a particular opportunity and responsibility. So I would invite any of you to talk more about that, this power to name a phenomenon or a need that the pandemic gave you and what it will do for your institution going forward to have named it and embraced it either as a challenge or as an opportunity.
Well, I'll throw one out for you that's a sort of an addendum to what I was saying before, but I think this, for us, one of the things that we really named was around mission. You know, what are we doing? And the sharpness around understanding and appreciating our mission and driving everything toward that was sort of central to how we came through the pandemic last year and where we are this year. And for us, everything leads with education. That's not always true at other universities or other priorities, and education may be one of them, but it's one among many. For us, it is central to what we do. And so for us, in the same way that at Wellesley they were feeling that sense of disconnect that some students felt when they were online, that sense of the disparate experience that people have when they're online, it was so critical for us to get people back, because we knew if we were going to carry out our mission in a fulsome way, in a way that did justice to who we are, then we needed to have people in our at our campus, which is basically, you know, a well-honed laboratory for learning, everything about it. And it creates a much more equitable experience for students overall. So for us, you know, mission, it was just so critical. And when we think about things that we named and we said we're going to keep out front all the time, that was it. And it truly helped guide us in terms of how we were going to get ourselves through this pandemic.
I'll add something. We were a bit of a bookend to where Paula and Wellesley were. We were at the end of a three-year process to develop a strategic plan for the next decade. We actually presented it to the board at a first Zoom board meeting in April of 2020, was the conclusion of that process. And the big question about it was, would the pandemic pivot us away from what we'd spent 3 years thinking about? And two of the major pillars of that plan are residential learning, diverse experiences for our students, and culture and community and embracing everyone on campus. And so coming out of the first year of the pandemic and coming into this year, not only had those two pillars been reinforced by the pandemic, I think they had really been highlighted as exactly the things that we should do, exactly the things we should do and be good at to be the university we wanted to be. Going into the pandemic and going online and going remote in March of 2020, there was a lot of skepticism, right? Were we looking at the new world? And I think we come out of it resolved that we are not. That the value of a residential education for those learners, 17 to 21, 22 years old, is a transformative experience when done very well.
I want to sort of address two different pieces in that idea of naming. I think before the pandemic, there was a lot of skepticism about the role of higher education for our society at all, right? A lot of talk about public good versus private good, the assumption that people were going to higher education and they were making their living and making their dollars, and education is no longer seen as that solution, that public solution. I think that question has gone away. There is no doubt in my mind that as I look at the way that universities and private colleges, small private colleges that are serving different populations and community colleges, that there's a recognition that higher education sectors are varied, that we're not a monolith, and we each serve a purpose, right? And we have each evolved to that purpose. And COVID showed me that, as Bob has said, you know, he's confirmed the purpose that he's had before, that this is an important experience for growing young people. For me, the having community colleges that with workforce development as its core, we're going to work towards the recovery post-COVID. I have a purpose, and we have evolved to that. And, you know, when I look at women's colleges that has brought feminine leadership and places like Colby, all of us need to survive because there's a place for every single segment of higher ed, and we're all for public good. I don't ever want anyone to question the fact that education is anything but public good. And I'm glad that it's gone away. So that kind of sort of naming and really confirming that naming, I think is important for all of us.
Yeah. And I would say, Pam, you know, I think that was evidenced by the fact that in Massachusetts, the work that we did together, I think, was extraordinary. There was a true sense amongst our peers that There were those who were, some of them were better resourced. Some people could do certain things, others couldn't. But that we were in this together because higher education is critically important. And it's critically important across the country, but here we were in the state, in all the different populations it served. And there was a lot of talk about places not surviving and this and that. And to tell you the truth, if it was every tub on its own bottom, I think it would have been even harder. And not that it's still not hard, but I think that there was a coming together of the industry, as you say, mm-hmm. and for the greater good. Yeah. And I think so as an industry, we valued each other.
So let's pick up on that. And I had told you before we started sort of my plan. It's gone. We're just going to keep going on these conversations because this is riveting. So that is the industry working together. And I was struck even before our formal conversation began tonight about the extent to which it's clear that you've talked to each other and are aware of what each other are doing. Talk about the relationship with the communities in which your institutions sit. Because I got a sense that there could be both collaboration and real tension. I think the town and gown characterization is unfortunate a lot of the time. But talk about the communities in which you're situated, either virtually or literally, and was there collaboration there?
Well, I think one of the things that all of us had to do to be successful, especially a summer ago, was develop real interfaces and call on interfaces we had with our cities and our local communities around us to make the case that we could operate safely. Because if you just recall what the world was like in June of 2020, there was a huge anxiety in our communities around that we were going to become hotbeds of COVID, right? And we had to work with the public health officials, with the politically elected people, and with neighborhoods to convince people that we could do this successfully and that we were going to be transparent about what we were doing so that they could watch us. And, you know, one of the things I think was amazing with, if you look at all the schools in the Boston area, essentially put up dashboards that showed the cases and showed how many tests they were doing and everything to make the community feel that they were being able to look in and monitor what was going on. And the reporting the relationships with the officials got much tighter than I've ever seen them before. All of that to get a comfort zone. I would say that coming into this year, it has all relaxed because they have faith in us. And we are still being as transparent as we have been before.
Is that true in Maine?
Well, Colby's home is Waterville, Maine, and Waterville is an old mill town, both textile and paper mills. So the economy has sort of been bottomed out of Waterville, as it has in many cities across the country. And for the last 7 years, we've spent time reinvesting in Waterville. We have $175 million of reinvestment in the four blocks of the downtown Main Street. We have new housing, we have hotels, we have art centers, we have technology centers that are all changing the nature of the city for the better, bringing back jobs, giving opportunities to people who've lived there for a long time. So we were working on that together with the city before the pandemic hit. And when the pandemic hit, we said we would stop none of that. We may stop other projects that are on campus, but we will not sacrifice anything that we're doing with the city. We'll continue to do that. And the, you know, we focused on a number of things, but values were also a huge part of it. When we talk about naming earlier, we just really wanted to name our values, what's important to us. And being a really strong member of this community where everything is reciprocal, it's not Colby telling others what to do, but we're actually in this together, was critical to us with all of this. So when the, you know, when we had to really shut things down in 2019, we kept every single person on staff. We didn't lay off one person. We didn't cut anybody's salaries. We didn't cut anybody's benefits. And when our food service workers didn't have work to do in our dining halls, we actually worked with them to be able to create meals that were then fed to people in the community. We did a number of different things like that, that were really engaged to say, we're all in this together. And that's the way we have to be in this community. And that's paid off for us, not just for Colby, but for the entire community. When we were coming back, went to meet with the city manager and the mayor and say, this is what we're thinking about doing. We're going to be testing everybody 3 times a week. Here are the protocols we're putting in place. And they were thrilled. And folks in town were thrilled to have everybody back because it's also important for businesses locally. The college plays a huge role in the economy of the local area. So that piece has worked very well for us, us meaning the community at large overall.
Stay with us. Coming up, we continue our conversation with four leaders of institutions of higher learning, picking up with how the pandemic has changed the way we think about residential life on college campuses. I'm Tiziana Dearing, and this is a special hour of Radio Boston. Welcome back to this special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. The Radio Boston team is on holiday break this week, and we're bringing you some of our favorite conversations from 2021. Today, a conversation with four presidents of area colleges and universities. And as you'll hear in this next portion, one of the greatest challenges this pandemic has presented has been its ever-changing nature. While some of the concerns our panelists expressed when we all sat down back in September are still incredibly present, like the lack of availability of rapid tests, others much less, like the anxiety around the Delta variant. Since then, Omicron has said to Delta, step aside. In fact, the cautious optimism you'll hear here that we had turned the corner and entered some sort of new normal is particularly crushing. But at the heart of the discussion is this lingering question. What can we learn from this time, dark though it may be, to help us get to a new normal and to make sure that life gets better for everyone? Again, you'll hear Pam Ettinger of Bunker Hill Community College, David Green of Colby College, Bob Brown of Boston University, and first up, Paula Johnson of Wellesley College, all presidents. Here's Paula Johnson talking about how her school is rethinking what it means to be residential.
You know, we had gone through strategic planning and now we're finished, but I think one focus for Wellesley over the past 5 years has really been what we call inclusive excellence, which is, you know, not only increasing the robustness of the diversity of our community in totality, both students, faculty, and staff, but also ensuring that, quite frankly, that the institution transforms in order to embrace that full diversity in the ways that we're talking about the backgrounds of our students. So it isn't good enough to just bring the students to campus. But how is it that pedagogy becomes more inclusive in the classroom? What does it look like to truly be inclusive in the residence halls and to make sure that that residential experience is purposefully thought about? And, you know, we've really doubled down on that, which is how do we make an incredible diversity of students feel this strong sense of belonging everywhere from the residence hall to the co-curricular and extracurricular activity to the classroom. And that is a transformative experience. And so I do think that that work in and of itself is work that will take, it's never going to be done because we're always evolving. But I think we're seeing some change, some really interesting changes. You know, this year we were, you know, without testing. We were test optional, not COVID testing, text optional, which really changed who we saw applying to our schools, allowed us to even bring in more students from diverse backgrounds. And so, but we have a responsibility with that. So,
excuse me to clarify, just for those listening who might not know, you mean standardized testing.
Standardized testing, yes. As I said, not COVID testing. That's mandatory.
So, okay. So I want to pick up on that for a second. And President Green, at the beginning of the 2020 academic year, Colby was featured on PBS for the return to school and how you were handling it. One of the things that you said in that interview that really struck me, and with a bit of fire, you talked about the importance of testing and how government had not gotten it right and that the universities had to do it themselves. And that really struck me because just recently, earlier this month, Dr. Ashish Jha, who's from Brown University, had an op-ed in the Boston Globe where he said, one of the ways to handle this is testing, massive, free, scaled up testing, and government isn't doing it. So here we are a year later, universities learned this lesson. You were expressing a little dismay, it sounded like, but also a sense of we're going to do this. What could universities do to bring more of what you've learned to do right into the larger COVID environment And how can you lead by example there?
I would say my dismay was more than a little. I would say, and it's
I was being soft.
It's still very high, actually, because the government still hasn't done nearly enough around this. And it's such a simple problem to solve. And the difference it makes is extraordinary in all of this. I have to say the work that Paula and her colleagues did on testing for Massachusetts is something that we looked very carefully at when we were thinking about reopening. That was a huge service to the community to be able to do that work in a thoughtful way. And we relied on testing in extraordinary fashion, and it showed us so much. Being able to catch people before they're actually contagious is a huge difference maker in this. The Delta has made that all the harder at this point. But for us, testing three times a week allowed us to really snap community transmission time and time again when it came up. And that was a big deal for us. And it's so simple. It's cheap and it's easy. And you know, I hear President Biden recently saying that he is ramping up the capacity for testing in this country. I'm glad to hear that. But, you know, we are 18 months or more late on that. And so it's one thing for us. You know, we can figure this out. If you're at Wellesley, if you're at BU, if you're at Colby, we can figure this out. We have resources in all different kinds of ways. If you're at Bunker Hill,
not so much.
Not so much. If you're at name your high school, your elementary school, the fact that the government did nothing to help schools open in any significant way, never provided testing in any real way to keep teachers safe, to keep students safe, to keep the parents safe when their kids are there. That, to me, is just such negligence on the part of our government. And it continues today. I mean, there still continues to be, you know, essentially one antigen test that's available in this country. And they've shut down their plants. It's almost impossible now to get rapid antigen tests, which are so essential to being able to have a cheap and effective method for keeping people safe in our country. So my dismay is a little more than...
Fair enough. President Brown, did you want to add?
Well, he is so right. I mean, if you go back to the spring of 2020, testing, my feeling about this is testing was so overpriced at the beginning, and that was the government's problem, that it pivoted all of the thinking in this country around that testing wasn't an option. And yet all the data that we started seeing, even in Paula and I were doing this late March and early April, you could see that this asymptomatic group of people that could carry the disease and transmit the disease was so large that without testing, you were hopeless. Right. And those two facts, I think, were terribly troubling to everyone. I'll give you an little anecdote that's interesting. We decided ourselves that we're going to build our own testing laboratory at BU. We have great public health people and biomedical engineers that designed it. And we were fully felt we could make this work. The thing we thought we couldn't do was buy the robots. Mm-hmm. To run the lab, because we put the robot order in mid-May, and everybody thought that they possibly have to be sold out because everybody has to be getting ready to build robotic labs. Mm-hmm. And we put the order in, and they filled the order in about 4 weeks, right? Which was a travesty. Right? Because the government had not mobilized. We had mobilized as a society, and this is now May. Right, June, to realize how important testing was. And I forget, Paula, when it was. It was in that time frame when finally the CDC said that, well, asymptomatic testing may be needed. Mm-hmm. For the first 4 months, they said, no, you should not That's be right. doing this. And so this was a terribly mismanaged part of the pandemic, which the universities, through Paula's good work in Massachusetts, got the message right. Yeah. And then the Broad Institute came online and made testing feasible, still expensive, but feasible for a lot of institutions.
So, President Johnson, I'll let you add there. And then we've got some questions from the audience, and I think we'll go to those next.
Well, I think that, you know, as Bob was saying, you know, I think, and Bob's leadership in this was really outstanding as well as our other colleague, Tony Monaco, and Lori Leshin. But it made it so clear that we do not have a public health system.
Nope.
The country does not have a public health system. And this pandemic has laid that quite bare. And it's so clear that we don't even understand what public health is. That's part of the problem. We have so defunded public health over many years that it isn't even clear to the population what a public health system should look like. We've got all these tubs on their own bottom without any central leadership, as David just talked about. So I truly hope that, you know, colleges and universities with important resources, and here in Boston, obviously, we've got, you know, some of Bob's faculty, we've had faculty from Harvard and other places come together very generously and really think about how we move forward, helped us develop protocols for this opening. But how do we take that now and say to the world, this is what public health looks like? We can't let this happen again.
Paula, until it works for my students, it does not work.
That's right.
That's what it comes down to. Because we are the community.
Right.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you short. Go ahead.
No. Okay. But you see now the inverse happening, mm-hmm. right? Because you see FEMA now coming out and talking about they're changing monthly how much they will reimburse institutions for testing. But this is 18 months too late. Because if they had had that 18 months ago,
that's right,
she would have been testing.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly. And it's still decentralized. Then,
yeah. It's
right?
Totally
it's not centralized.
No. But if they had come out and the government had said, this is what we'll reimburse, this is what a test is going to cost, and we're going to reimburse this set of institutions, and community colleges would have been high on that list,
yeah.
right? It would have played out differently.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're listening to a special hour of Radio Boston. It's part of a WBUR City Space series called This Changes Everything. Stay with us. When we return, we'll continue the conversation with these four university presidents from back in September, and we will bring in questions from the audience. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We are taking time today to revisit a conversation with four area college and university presidents that we had back in September at WBUR City Space, part of a City Space series called This Changes Everything. We've heard the panel weigh in on residential life, the need for testing support, the role colleges and universities can and should play in their larger communities, and how the challenges of the pandemic have resharpened each school's focus and their mission. We ended our conversation last fall by opening questions to the audience. Again, four university presidents: David Green of Colby College, Bob Brown of Boston University, Paula Johnson of Wellesley College, and Pam Ettinger, Bunker Hill Community College, who fielded the first audience question about the inequities in resources and opportunity that the pandemic exposed and the efforts they undertook to make sure students didn't fall behind simply because they came from a disadvantaged community or background.
So hotspots and laptops and Chromebooks. Mm-hmm. We purchased hundreds of them, and we simply gave them out. And we're finding that students, even when they're in the inner city, supposedly with this kind of, you know, Wi-Fi coverage, they simply couldn't get to us. So we wired our parking lots so students can come to the parking lots and get access to Wi-Fi. It's not pretty. It is the technology equivalent of what we don't have in public health. Mm-hmm. So public communications, public health, it's all in one piece.
And does that become permanent now? Will Chromebooks be permanent? Will hotspots be permanent?
We will continue raising money to give those out because we said that it's a loaner system, but we say to the students, until you're done with your degree, you don't have to give them back. Right, so it's almost a relatively long-term permanent loan, and those things only have 2 or 3 years' worth of really useful life. So yeah, we will continue to do that. We were giving them out through our food pantry. It's kind of ironic, but you know, it's basic needs. And technology is part of that.
Did you want to add something?
No, I was just going to say we did the same thing in terms of computers and hotspots. But then there were students, and being a residential campus, there were students for whom it wasn't only a matter of technology. They couldn't be home. Yeah. And for those students, we just kept them. You know, there's a whole population that we just could not allow to leave because it wasn't either safe or the conditions were so poor. Yeah. And so I think it was really, you had to take it student by student and figure out what they needed.
Here's a question from David Dawson. How will your strategic and crisis planning change to be more prepared? Is seeking or accepting a new normal the way to project and prepare for future crises? President Green.
Well, I think we learned a lot in terms of how to kind of structure decision making at a time when you couldn't really see ahead. That was probably the toughest part about the first stages of the pandemic, was all of the uncertainty. There's still uncertainty, but where we are now relative to where we were in March 2019 are two entirely different places. And we had to make so many different decisions at that point and get people together thinking hard around how do we move forward in all of this. And for us, you know, we did that in ways that I think will last with us. We really started by just enumerating our values because we said if we can't see ahead, we have to be guided by something. And these values and principles will guide us. And that's been a mantra for us ever since. But also the structures we've put in place around decision-making from that time have been hugely effective, much stronger communication across different areas of the institution, for example. And I think those will maintain through any crisis coming up in a way that will benefit us.
Next question. And the question is, colleges have always had to deal with loss of life on their campuses. Have any lessons been found in how to honor deceased members of your college communities? And in doing so, President Brown, I do want to acknowledge the loss this weekend of Associate Professor David Jones from the School of Public Health. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry for that loss. If it's not too much of a burden to then turn that question to you.
This is always a huge challenge in a community as large as ours. You know, we have about 45,000 people in the community. And so the loss of life or even a serious illness is very localized in many cases. David's tragic death has affected everyone, right? But one of the things that we see the way we grieve, it turns out to be relatively local in schools and colleges because we're so big, right? And so there's not, as a university, many people knew David, had met David, but not a large number of the faculty. And so it's a property of the university that's somewhat different than a small community where it's much more closely knit. So we tend to grieve as a university in the schools and colleges and in the administration unit where the loss happened. We were fortunate in the pandemic. There were two employees that passed away during the pandemic. Both were a staff. Neither was affected by getting the disease on campus. In fact, one wasn't actually actively working when they acquired the disease. But they were both in the custodial staff, and it really had a big impact on the custodial staff. And so we kind of quietly grieved there.
This next question, I'm just going to adapt it a little bit. It pinged in on, President Johnson, your note about going standardized test optional. So the general question is, how about going forward with standardized tests?
Well, I'll just lead off to say that this year will be test optional again. And I think we're learning. And, you know, they're obviously the UC system has gone without testing. So I think we know that testing is a proxy in some ways for socioeconomic status. And so how we think about what we learn being test optional is going to be very important for how we think about the diversity of our communities. I don't know where we're going to end up. We're part of a group that's actually studying this with the Educational Testing Service, and we'll see how things move forward.
So I'm going to use a quote actually from you, President Johnson, from an event, a virtual discussion that you did with WBUR mm-hmm. several months ago, to pose a question to any of you who would like it. The quote was, President Johnson, "We have not taken seriously the evaluation of what it means to try to tear down structural racism in our medical system, in our institutions, institution by institution." And I think the question that I'd like to ask each of any of you who would like to answer it, what do you need to tear down in your institution, and how are you doing it?
I think that when you think about the higher education in a major research university, it's about everyone having a clear view and understanding bias in all its forms. Right. Standardized testing is one for which there's been a lot of analysis and good work done that gives you enough correlations that you can understand the bias. There was a recent study out of Stanford School of Education talking about letters of reference and biases in the letters of reference. Mm-hmm. Right. And what Paula's phrase, which I really like very much, inclusive excellence, the whole issue is how do we understand where bias is creeping in to the evaluations we're making about who's a member of our community and how our community interacts. Mm-hmm. You know, in a perfect world, what we really want is from a student, faculty, staff, is once you're a member of the community, once you're in, we do everything you can possibly do for you to be successful and find your place in that community so you can thrive. And we have to understand where the biases are in our system that it's keeping that from happening for people. First on entry, but entry is not enough. These biases exist inside our living system. They exist inside the classroom and the way material is presented. It's a lot of hard work that's going to go on, and it's going to go on for years to kind of tease that out. And so that everyone recognizes where it is. And I still believe in the goodness of people. If they recognize it, that's half the battle, right? Because once you recognize it, you figure out how to work with it to still be able to build an excellent community, but not built on those biases.
Go ahead, President. We'll just go down the line.
This is always a difficult question when you're the community college along the line of universities and selective colleges. And I always recall Jamie Marisotis, who was a past president of the Lumina Foundation. And he wrote a book where he talks about talent. At my college, we are 65% Pell eligible. That's the number, the percentage of students who are receiving Pell. At any of my colleagues' colleges, you may be hovering somewhere around 10, 15, and that's high, right? So when you look at that gap, is there really such a large gap in talent in our society where 40% of students who are eligible for Pell would not be admitted to our selective colleges? So is it about capacity? Is it about the way that our selective colleges are structured? Is it possible to accommodate more students who are low income and yet have the talent? So I agree with Bob in that, yes, there's something about the selection process, right, where you have to get rid of the biases in order to admit more students. But I think it's more than that, in that there is a historical and structural restriction of talents from low income areas of our society that what we're struggling against is not just the selection process, but a structural process. I mean, is it possible for Bob's place or Paula's place or your place to accommodate more than 10% or 15% Pell eligible students? It may not be possible.
We have 24.
And if you're going to accommodate them, let me give them
I've
to you.
Well, I have 20%.
See, right?
That's we have 24. Our first year class is almost 25%.
There's 700 Pell students in my freshman class.
And that's fabulous. But that is not usual.
No, you work at it. It is.
You have to work at it.
It's intentional.
Work at it.
So, President Green, you were going to say something, and we are close to the end here, and I'm a stickler on time.
I'll be quick, but I think you asked about tearing things down. I want to say something about building things up, because I think, you know, what we actually do best is we do education and we do scholarship. And in the 1970s, when colleges and universities began taking the issue of environmental policy and climate science seriously, it built up an entire body of work and a group of educated people who understood this in a way that we're seeing the results of that today, and people who are anxious for change on this, but doing it in a way that is based on real evidence over time. We need to do the same thing around issues of structural inequalities, and we need to have academic programs, scholarly programs that are not just in individual disciplines, but crossing all of them. We're working on that right now. So that's sort of fundamental to what we're teaching people and the way that we're our scholarship evolves over time, so that we're, you know, not continually remaking this over time, but that we're really in a position in a broad societal way to make sort of fundamental changes.
Thank you. And actually, President Johnson, there is time.
Oh, so this can't be, as I like to say, the flavor of the day. We are living through the pandemic of COVID. We're living through an awakening around structural racism, and we're living through an economic nightmare for a very large part of the population. At some point, this will pass, but this work can't stop. And I think that's the only way we're going to tear it down. And I spoke earlier about the transformation of our institutions that I think we've all been talking about. It's the work that we have to do. It is the hard work. We didn't get here overnight. This has been part of the fabric of our country, and we're not going to fix it overnight. But it's going to take the ongoing commitment of all of us and our successors in order to make this different. And I think that's the hard part, keeping our eye laser beam focused on this work.
That was Paula Johnson, president of Wellesley College, Pam Ettinger, president of Bunker Hill Community College, David Green, president of Colby College, and Bob Brown, president of Boston University. The four joined me for a conversation back in September titled "This Changes Everything," part of a WBUR City Space event. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, and Amanda Beland. Marquis Nail is our technical director, Karen Schiffman, our interim executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for another special hour of Radio Boston.